Good afternoon. I would like to call to order this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Today's February 28th. And the first order of business, as always, is to take the roll. Ms. Niedernhofer.
Liebling.
Present.
Hewitt.
Present.
Schumacher.
Schumacher, present.
Ackland.
Ackland, present.
Becker. Becker. Bonner.
Present.
Bierman.
Present.
Bolden. Bolden. Dameth.
Dameth, present.
Freiberg.
Present.
Grunhagen.
Present.
Keel.
Present.
Morrison.
Morrison, present.
Munson.
Munson, present.
Pryor.
Pryor, present.
Quam.
Present.
Ryer.
Ryer, present.
Schultz.
Present.
Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
A quorum is present.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Niedernhofer. Representative Ryer, would you be able to move the minutes for February 23rd?
Certainly, Madam Chair. I move the minutes for
February 23rd, our last
February meeting. 23rd. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I went to you because you had a couple of bills that day that are in those minutes. So is there any discussion to the minutes? All right, seeing none, please unmute yourselves for a voice vote. All in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Aye. The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Thank you. So members, today's agenda, we have a couple of bills having to do with lead in drinking water. I think this should be a very interesting day. And then after we get through those bills, and they will both be laid over for possible inclusion, and then we also will have a report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor on the Emergency Services Regulatory Board and the ambulance services generally. So it should be a very interesting day. So our first up, we have, I skipped, of course, that we're going to start with an overview from the Department of Health about the topic of lead abatement and hear a little bit about what is in the governor's proposal regarding lead abatement. So let's see, we have, who was here to give that overview?
Chair Liebling, I'm here to provide the overview on
Welcome.
Behalf of the Department of Health. Thank you. And for the record, my name is Tani Eschenauer, and I'm the Water Policy Manager in the Environmental Health Division at the Department of Health. And we want to thank the committee for the welcome to share about this important area in which we continue to protect the health of Minnesotans. And I'm sure you're all aware of the tragedy in Flint, and all along in Minnesota, we've been taking action to prevent something like that happened. And now with recent changes at the federal level, we have a window of opportunity, and we really want to be able to be flexible and nimble to take care of these federal dollars and also have our state dollars complement that to get the most bang for our buck. So next slide, please. As you're aware, there is no safe level of lead exposure. Over the years, as the toxicology has gotten better, we realize there's not a threshold. And so taking lead out of the drinking water supply is really critical for our youngest and most vulnerable Minnesotans. We don't typically find lead in source water. It's not naturally occurring in our rivers, lakes, streams, not in our groundwater, unless there was some kind of industrial accident. The way it enters our drinking water is through the human-made infrastructure. So primarily, there's two sources. One is lead service lines. Those are lines that connect the water main that runs under their streets in front of our homes. and pipes it into our home by the water meter. And so that contributes about 50% of the lead that might be found in drinking water. The other 50% comes from what we call premise plumbing. And that's pipes that are in our house, that's solder that might contain lead, and often faucets can contain lead. For example, if they're made of brass, that is a composite that includes lead. There has been increasingly tighter regulation of lead, but we're particularly concerned about homes that were built before 1986. There still can be some limited lead, but it's much less. Next slide, please. So the legislature, at the recommendation of the Clean Water Council, gave us an appropriation to look at all the potential sources of lead in our drinking water and to look at what it might cost to remove those sources of lead, and then what would be the benefit to us as a state if we spent the money to do that, a cost-benefit analysis. And for that analysis, we collaborated with the Humphrey School of Public Affairs and the Water Resources Center at the University of Minnesota. And as you can see on this slide, the cost for replacing lead service lines was such that for every dollar it might cost us, there's easily $2 in benefits to the state of Minnesota in increased earning potential and productivity. And I will say that the one criticism that we had of this report was from a national non-governmental group who said that we severely underestimated the benefits, but we did want to be conservative because these are public dollars. Next slide. So an important first step in going after the lead service lines that connect the water main to people's homes is to know how many lead service lines are out there. They're an important part of our distribution system. Originally, systems may have done an inventory many years ago under the initial lead and copper rule that's part of the Safe Drinking Water Act, but those inventories have not been maintained over time. So the recent revision of the lead and copper rule, which passed in December, now requires that systems do a new inventory, and it's due by October 2024. The challenge is that community water systems, that's what that acronym is for on the slide, they largely lack the resources to do this. You may be aware that in Minnesota, we are a state of many, many small water systems. About 90% of our public water systems serve a population that is less than 3,300. And half of those serve a population less than 500. So the folks that run those systems often have many responsibilities within their community. And we would like for those lead service line locations to be added to a tool that is already online. It was a cooperative venture between originally the state auditor, now the University of Minnesota, and the Department of Health, where you can look up the age of your infrastructure. And so it would be an easy add to that existing online tool, and people would be able to go there and look and see whether or not the home that they're about to purchase has a lead service line, or whether or not the home they're living in still has a lead service line, or if it's been replaced. Next slide, please. So the governor has a proposal for lead service line inventories, and that these would be a part of a broader asset management plan. It includes about $3,750,000 a year for 2 years, plus two staff to manage the program. And we estimate that it would cost an average of $10,000 per system for about 750 water systems in the state. And again, we would like this to be part of an overall asset management plan. These are important plans which help a system to know the age of the various components. It helps them plan so that they have an appropriate rate structure in place and helps them not be surprised by excess water main breaks and other failures. Next slide, please. So there is funding coming from the federal government for the replacement of lead service lines. This will be channeled through the existing Drinking Water State Revolving Fund, or we call it DWRF for short. At the current time, the privately owned portion of the lead service line can receive a 50% grant, but the entire lead service line must be replaced to receive grant funds. And you may or may not be aware that when there's a lead service line, depending on the municipality or the community, sometimes the entire line is owned by the homeowner. Sometimes the ownership is split at the curb stop, and the municipality or water system owns from the main to the curb stop, and the homeowner owns the rest. But we know from a public health perspective that partial replacements are not a good thing to do. And in fact, they can increase the amount of lead in drinking water because the replacement process disturbs the scale that's formed along the inside of the pipe and releases lead, more lead into the drinking water. So this is the channel that we are currently using, and we want these funds to be able to go to the community water supply so that they can work with the homeowners and with the public works folks to have these lead service lines replaced in a consistent manner in a way that they're accountable to this community water system. Next slide, please. You've heard, I'm sure, about the large amount of funding that's coming from the federal government from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. For Minnesota, this will amount to about $43 million a year for 5 years. Currently, the way that the strings are attached to these dollars, it's a split between grants to these community water systems and loans. And we know that this loan portion will be a challenge for some of our community water systems. So we're hoping that we can use state dollars to make these grants more widely available and help us to be more nimble and flexible in our funding. As I mentioned earlier, the community water systems will need to apply for the funding. They're used to doing this through our state revolving fund. And we also have some language changes that are being proposed so that we can use grant funds for the replacement of the entire lead service line and hopefully speed up the process, make it more easy to be completed. Next slide, please. If we turn to the topic of schools, in Minnesota, we do have legislation that requires schools to test for lead. As I mentioned, lead service lines is one source, but an additional source can be within the building. And so every school, public school and charter school in the state of Minnesota is required to test every 5 years. They have a model plan, which we put together for them, available on our website, but they are not required to provide their results to the state health department. They do have access to a general fund called a long-term facilities maintenance plan if they wish to take action to reduce lead exposures within their buildings. But as you can imagine, the competition for those funds can be quite tight. Next slide, please. Through the Department of Health, we have a grant from the US EPA. It's called a WIN grant, and we are able to provide testing supplies and pay for laboratory testing for public schools and licensed childcares. It does not provide funds for remediation. As you can imagine, the response from childcares has been quite limited because they have no access for these smaller businesses to be able to fund remediation. So another proposal from the governor is that we offer lead remediation in schools and childcare settings grants, and that is a request for $5.1 million for FY23 and FY24. Next slide, please. And then there's been some questions about private wells and how are they exposed to lead possibly in drinking water, and then childcares that are operated out of private homes. We don't have to worry about lead service lines with private wells, but there are components used at times in constructing wells and in the household plumbing, just like for a city home, that can contribute lead to that. So we do have recommendations for testing for lead in our well owner's homework. And as a Department of Health, we recommend that well owners do test for lead once in the lifetime of the well. There's also been questions about rental properties. Rental properties that are a part of a community water system will be eligible for lead service line replacement through our DORF funds. And the ones that might be on private wells will be more challenging because often there's confusion about who is responsible for what. Next slide, please. So I'll just close with our vision that we believe drinking water should be safe for everyone, everywhere in Minnesota. It's one of the essential conditions for having a healthy community and a healthy economy. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll be glad to take questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Eschenauer. That is really helpful. And I think that we probably had the slides sent out too, so members can go back. I know I will go back and look at that again, and we'll look forward to more work on this. So hand up from Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Early on, the testifier made a statement that records had been not maintained. I'm trying to better understand, because there was a break off of where from there forward, everything had to be lead free. So, you know, schools and some cities like Rochester, where whole neighborhoods weren't around before that break in. Is the testifier saying that the records during that transition period are lost?
Ms. Eschenauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. There was a requirement in the beginning when the first lead and copper rule passed for systems to have an inventory of their lead service lines. However, the quality and the accuracy of that really varies. And that was probably 30 years ago. And so many systems have not maintained those lead service line inventories. Some systems might have them on 3x5 cards. Others might have them digitally. It really depends on the capacity of the system.
Madam Chair.
Representative Kwan.
Then it would behoove any bill or legislation going forward to look at, I guess, the funding of digitizing or ensuring the integrity of that older data. I think that would be more common sense. Plus, with the testing periods and et cetera, being on a school board, when we built a new school, we had to meet the codes. And so I would think there would be records so that a different periodicity or periodic sampling rate for something that was built in the last 10 years, basically we need to be, you know, intelligent, because we need to address the stuff that is really bad, that's been around for many decades. In fact, we even have extra LGA for cities that have large portions of older housing. And I think we need to see about prioritizing. The biggest improvement is going to be, you know, the really old systems, especially in small towns and et cetera. So as this discussion goes on, it's disheartening that, gee, we don't really have records that we can trust, or the ones that were around, we don't know if any of that's around. So, you know, the broader discussion may be a prioritization if we're going to do it over years. And I'd like to see that in any bill that comes forward that prioritizes the biggest impact first. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Kwan. Ms. Eschenauer, do you want to respond briefly to you look like you had something to say about the reporting issue.
Sure, Madam Chair, thank you. And Representative, you point out some important considerations, and we've already been working with our systems to update them on the requirements of the lead and copper rule and helping them to think about creative and efficient ways they can go about determining where these lead service lines. So we're asking them to look at installation records that they might have, plumbing permits that they have, plans and specifications that might be similar to what you talked about for schools. But ultimately, we think systems are going to have to do a fair amount of going out and going in people's yards and digging in the yard of the street to see what the composition of these lead service lines are. So it's going to be quite a challenge, and we really want to be able to support these community systems to be both effective and efficient.
All right, thank you. I'm going to call on Representative Ryer, and then when she gets done with her question and answer, we will move on to the bill. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Eschenauer. This was very helpful, and it's interesting to hear it in the context of being on the bonding committee and having visited many of the very small towns and seen the condition of their water systems. It is truly a burden for them to manage that. My question is, you had noted, I think, that schools test, but they're not required to report. And I'm wondering how we came to that situation, and especially if there's a different place where families can go to find out about the water in their children's schools. Thank you.
Ms. Eschenauer? Oh, you are muted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry about that, Representative. The legislation doesn't require that it be reported to the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm not sure about the history of how that came to be. It does require that public notice be given to parents, and many schools have it displayed on their website, both the sites where it was tested and the facilities and what the results were for the testing.
Okay. Representative Breyer, any follow-up? Okay. Very good. Well, Ms. Eschenauer, thank you so much. I hope you can stay with us in case there are any other questions, because, of course, our bills today are very much related to your presentation. So thank you. Okay, so next up is Representative Jordan, and she is not on our committee. So the chair will move that House File 2650 be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm excited to present House File 2650, a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead in their drinking water through lead service lines. Members, this is fundamentally a bill to protect Minnesotans from exposure to lead. If there's one takeaway I want us all to walk away today, it is that no amount of exposure to lead is safe. As you just heard from Mrs. Eschenauer, lead service lines are one of the largest sources of lead in Minnesota's drinking water. Often lead service lines are both publicly and privately owned, and therefore we must replace both parts simultaneously to avoid increasing lead concentration in drinking water. Lead exposure through drinking water is a statewide issue. Lead service lines are present across Minnesota in all communities, urban, suburban, and rural. Lead exposure through service lines is most common in lower income communities. Many cities and townships do not have a comprehensive map of lead lines. House File 2650 creates a grant program to fund the removal of all lead service lines in Minnesota. Cities may use these grants to identify and, map their existing lead lines, remove and replace lead lines, and maximize federal funding for lead line replacement. Priority is given to removal projects in census tracts with concentrated poverty or located in designated opportunity zones. Priority is also given to projects submitted by business owners, color, and female business owners. Projects must also employ contractors who pay employees at the prevailing wage rate. Furthermore, cities can also use these grants to maximize federal funding for their projects. I am still working on this bill to maximize federal funding and ensure this bill meets the needs of Minnesota cities, townships, workers, and water drinkers from War Road to Winona. And the EPA is still working on guidelines for distributing infrastructure money related to lead service lines, and this bill will evolve as we have more information. We're expecting that guidance as soon as Thursday, and so the bill will take a different shape once we receive that. It will also have a different funding amount, and I am sure that none of us want to leave federal funding on the table to improve the health and well-being of our constituents. I'm currently working with the Minnesota Department of Health, the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, union members, and clean water advocates, and would welcome all of your help as well. Above all, House File 2650 seeks to minimize Minnesotans' exposure to lead in our drinking water. Not only will this bill improve our quality of life, but a report by the Minnesota Department of Health and the University of Minnesota, which is the report that Ms. Eschenauer just went over, in 2019 found that for every dollar spent on addressing lead in our drinking water, we would see at least $2 return in benefits from better health outcomes. That same report is where the initial $300 million estimate comes from, but we're still awaiting that final guidance on cost, as I stated earlier. That number will change. Members, I can send a link to this report, and it is what Ms. Eschenauer just went over. It's well worth reading in its entirety, and policy recommendations are at the end. So remember, members, no amount of exposure to lead is safe, and this bill addresses the most common source of lead contact in Minnesota. Thank you for prioritizing lead abatement this afternoon, and I'd like to turn over to testimony.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Jordan. And I think we'll hold questions until we get through our testifiers. So we do have three people. So first person on my list is Elizabeth Weffel from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Elizabeth Weffel, and I am a senior attorney at Flaherty & Wood. I'm here on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, which is an advocacy organization of more than 110 cities throughout the state outside the metro area. Our cities are at the forefront of ensuring our citizens have clean drinking water. And like many of you, we are concerned about the presence of lead in water. I'm here to emphasize the statewide nature of this problem. As the author said, it's not just a metro problem. It's not just a big city problem. It really is lead pipes and fixtures are a concern throughout our state. As the testifier from MDH stated, you know, homes built before 1940 have lead service lines that connect them to public water. Plumbing systems built before 1986 may have lead parts. If you think about it, that describes a lot of housing in Greater Minnesota. 38% of cities in Greater Minnesota have over one-third of their housing stock built pre-1940s. That's compared to 3.6% in the metro area. We don't know how many of those houses have lead pipes or fixtures, but there's a high likelihood that many of them do, which is why we need legislation like this that will help map and identify where the lead connections are, as well as help replace them. This bill is also directed at helping homeowners with this issue, and that's really important because typically the houses with lead pipes and fixtures are the houses of those least able to afford to make replacements. And that's another reason why we strongly support putting money towards those issues. On average, incomes are lower in Greater Minnesota. If you look at the last five-year available average, the median household income in Greater Minnesota is $53,086 compared to $93,659 in the metro area. That means there are likely many affected households in Greater Minnesota who cannot afford to address this important health issue on their own. We think that the lead pipe issue needs to be addressed across the state, both in the metro and in Greater Minnesota. We support bills like this one that take an important step forward in lead line replacement. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Ms. Weffel. John Thorson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Thorson. I'm Legislative Director for LIUNA Minnesota, North Dakota. We're Minnesota's infrastructure union, representing more than 13,000 skilled construction laborers who build and maintain our roads, highways, bridges, sources of energy and transmission, and the basic utilities that allow our communities to thrive. The 2020 Local Jobs and Projects Bill, combined with federal funds from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Investments and Jobs Act, together are a strong foundation and critical down payment for addressing what is Minnesota's estimated $11.5 billion need for water infrastructure improvements across the state over the next 20 years. A robust approach by this legislature can be a truly transformational investment in our state's future and put us on a path to removing the over 100,000 lead lines that threaten our health by contaminating our drinking water. We strongly support the provisions of House File 2650 that call for eliminating all lead service lines in our state by 2032. And would provide the direct grant funding necessary to ensure that cities can map, identify, and replace the public right-of-way and private portions of lead service lines. This investment will make Minnesotans safer, make us healthier, and create family-supporting construction careers. LIUNA members are skilled in lead service line replacement. We take pride in working to help our own communities address drinking water needs and have worked on lead pipe replacements in many communities throughout our region. We collaborate with cities to leverage our expertise and our union training centers to accelerate the identification and elimination of these dangerous lead pipes in our communities. Our registered apprenticeship programs are supporting critical efforts to increase participation of women, people of color, veterans, and other underrepresented groups in the workforce. And the socioeconomic impacts of a career that pays middle-class wages, provides comprehensive family health care, retirement benefits, and offers opportunities for training and advancement can exceed those created by lower wage, no benefit jobs by a factor of five or more. We encourage your support for a multi-path effort for making critical state investments, which will ensure lead pipes are replaced and clean drinking water is delivered to families and children across Minnesota to increase the health, social, and economic vitality of our entire state. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thorson. And then finally, we have Helen Davis. Ms. Davis, just if you would introduce yourself and
one over here.
Okay.
Hello, everyone. My name is Helen Davis, and I'm here in Duluth, Minnesota. I am a mother who had a son that was had lead, high lead in his system. And it's been many years because he'd be 38 this year. I'm a parent here that had very concerned about lead up children getting a hold to lead. My I had like four students from Denfield High School this last year went around to housing out east here in Duluth, Minnesota, in the area. And these houses that they went to, Shanice and her dad went to, was out. The houses was built before 1925. And these houses, we found out it was like six houses had lead, high lead in the water system. And these houses that have been built, they come kind of close, and they also have a creek that's a little further down the road. And I'm very concerned about the people in the neighborhood up in that area, especially we have an elder lady that's living there, and hers was the highest one. And by her being an elder, these elder people is very don't know when they're going through dementias and stuff, that they don't know that they have these lead into the water pipes and stuff. And I think that they would to have more people out checking on those in that area, not just on the south side, north side of Duluth, but just in the area on 11th Street and 10th West 9th Street up there in Duluth, here in Duluth, Minnesota. It needs to be tested in each one homes to be tested, because we do have children in that area, very heavy with children in that area. And I am from Chicago, Illinois. And like I said, I just moved here in 2004. I've been here, and I never talked about lead until I met Mr. Anderson here in Duluth, Minnesota, working with him with the lead process. And this has really been going on real bad here in Duluth, Minnesota. So we need people more on board. And if we can get fundings, we can get anything that can help these peoples, for us, our youth, our elders as well, the going to these homes, these buildings, these schools, the workplaces where we go to restaurants. We all need to stick together, come as a team, as unity, to get this done. Because people, you don't know why they have mental and physical health problems because of lead, and we don't know nothing about it, especially our elders that got older and then got dementia. So I'm very concerned about that as a parent and a community leader here in Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Ms. Davis. Appreciate your being here with us today. Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome. Thank everyone to have me.
All right. So I had seen a question, but the hand was put down. So we do have an amendment to the bill, and that would be Representative Ackland. Representative Ackland, did you want to move your amendment?
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
All right. So Ms. Ackland is moving Representative Ackland is moving the A2 amendment. And would you care to discuss your amendment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And while I'm thinking of it, I would like to request a roll call vote.
All right, so, a roll call having been requested, there will be a roll call.
So what this amendment is focusing on is making sure that those communities that have the worst lead in their drinking water get those pipes with lead replaced first. So it's indisputable that there is no safe amount of lead for humans. The toxin is especially dangerous, though, for children, and even small amounts can inhibit brain development and intellectual ability. In 1986, Congress banned the use of lead pipes, solder, and flux, but allowed those already in the ground to remain. And a couple of the testifiers have commented on this fact. Some properties built before 1940 may have lead service lines that connect them to public water. Plumbing systems built before 1986 may still have lead parts. Minnesota has the 10th highest number of lead pipes of any state in the nation. So though there is no safe level of lead, those children that test in the highest ranges of blood lead levels are associated with additional and more extreme health effects, such as extreme problems with brain function called encephalopathy, severe neurological damage, coma, and even death. Children at greatest risk for lead poisoning in drinking water are those living in homes built prior to 1986. This amendment would prioritize testing and remediation in census tracts that identify that more than half of the buildings were built before 1986. The bill, as it's currently written, prioritizes based on income, prioritizes based on minority-owned businesses, and projects submitted by women-owned businesses. So while what this amendment is focusing on is making sure that those communities, regardless of their zip code, regardless of whether or not it is an affluent community or a struggling underserved community, that those communities that have the worst lead in their pipes, that those communities whose infants and children are at the greatest risk, that those communities would get their lead pipes replaced first. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd ask for member support.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ackland. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Ackland, for reminding everyone that no amount of lead level is safe. I know this is the third time you've heard this bill, so I'm glad that you understood the assignment and remember that. One thing I would remind, I unfortunately would ask members to vote against this amendment because it really removes all priorities. Members, we're not removing just every lead service line. We're not removing every service line, only the ones that are contaminated with lead. So this bill would not replace lead lines that do not have lead in them. The other thing I would remind members is that the neighborhood in which the home was built is not necessarily an indicator of how a homeowner would be able to pay for the line. I'm thinking about, my community, for example, Linden Hills and Kenwood in Minneapolis would both fit under this, but that is not a neighborhood where many of the residents would struggle with paying for the cost of replacing the line, unlike neighborhoods in my district or in many towns across greater Minnesota. So I appreciate your interest, Representative Ackland. Happy to keep working with you, but this amendment would remove a lot of important priorities.
Representative Hewitt.
Yes, Madam Chair. Real quick to the author of the amendment. Representative Ackland, it seems like to do it in the way and the fashion the amendment is written, and you yourself are saying it's more, we have more problems with this with our younger generation, our pediatric children. Wouldn't it be best to write a bill that or an amendment that would only say that we would do pediatric housing first and then move on? I mean, does that make sense? I'm just kind of curious why we didn't go that route.
Representative Ackland.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. The reason I didn't go that route is because after 1986, lead in the pipes has been outlawed. So we need to focus on the houses that were built before 1986 that are the most likely to have lead in the pipes. This, water in the pipelines is not the only source of lead. I understand that. But before 1986, there were lead service lines and there's lead solder, lead flux. And so if we can, within these areas, within these census tracts, if we can identify that 50% of those houses were actually built before 1986, they are the most likely ones to have these lead service lines or lead in their pipes. And so my thought in bringing this to the legislature is this, that the age of the house is a very important parameter for prioritizing. And I didn't see that in any of the priorities that were listed here. So I wanted to make that because that house, if a child's in that house and they're an infant, by the time 10 years rolls by, the damage may already be done. So I just say, let's prioritize the age of the house, which is most likely to have lead pipes.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. I guess I'm not seeing that that's what the amendment does, but okay. Representative Pryor and then Jordan, and then we'll get to a vote. Representative Pryor.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll be brief. I'm sitting in a neighborhood that's all built before 1986, but it's also one of the more wealthiest neighborhoods in the state. And each one of us can afford for these to make these changes. So I can't see in terms of testing how we would be a priority, especially since it's a very well-educated neighborhood. And we are, it's easy for us to comprehend the risk of lead and take actions with our cities to get it fixed. So I do believe in the way the bill is written without this amendment, maybe in terms of abatement, we can also, you know, there might be some combination of density of houses and things like that, but appreciate your priorities, Representative Jordan.
All right, thank you, Representative Pryor. I'm gonna call on Representative Quam, and then I'm gonna give Representative Jordan the last word. Representative Quam, if you could be brief, please, because we do have other bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And whatever ends up happening with this amendment, I think prioritizing neighborhoods and areas, because the mains also are probably older in those areas. And I'd prefer not to discriminate against any group. Poisoning is poisoning. And if grandchildren show up to a grandparent's home because they're in a neighborhood that wasn't prioritized, let's just plain aim at the worst case first. Thank you.
All right, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Chair Lee Wayne. To just put a finer point on this, if a home was constructed after the ban on lead service lines was put in, it's not eligible for one of these grants. If there's no lead service line, we're not going to replace it because it's the problem is already addressed. So in essence, this amendment really does remove prioritization And I think the priorities around disadvantaged communities is more important. Thank you.
All right. So I thank you very much for the good discussion, members. And I would just say that if we had all the money we needed, we wouldn't need to prioritize, and we could replace every darn lead piece of lead in, that's getting into our water supply. But unfortunately, we don't have that and probably won't for quite a while. So Ms. Niedernhofer, please take the roll on the amendment.
Chair Liebling.
No.
Vice Chair Hewitt.
No.
Hewitt, no. Lead Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Aye. Representative Ackland.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Representative Backer.
Backer, aye.
Our tree center is actually located on the lower level. We have a meeting.
Representative Grunhagen, please mute.
Did you get that, Backer? Votes aye.
Back.
Thank you.
I think you're muted.
Sorry, Representative Bonner.
Yay.
Bonner, no. Representative Bierman.
No.
Ready to go.
No. Representative Bolden.
Bolden, no.
Bolden, no. Representative Damoth.
Damoth votes aye.
Damoth, aye. Representative Freiberg.
Freiberg votes no.
Freiberg, no. Representative Grunhagen.
Grunhagen, aye.
Grunhagen, aye. Representative Keel.
Keel, aye.
Keel, aye. Representative Morrison. Representative Morrison. Representative Munson. Representative Munson. Representative Pryor.
Pryor, no.
Pryor, no. Representative Quam.
Affirmative.
Quam, aye. Representative Ryer.
No.
Ryer, no. Representative Schultz.
No.
Schultz, no. Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, no.
Wolgamott, no. Now I'll go back to Representative Morrison. Representative Munson. Okay, there are 7 ayes and 10 nays.
There being 7 ayes and 10 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. So with that, we are going to lay over House File 2650 for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Jordan. Now we have House File 3003. Representative Akam is here, and Representative Freiberg. This was heard in the Preventative Health Division, and Representative Freiberg, did you want to move to adopt the division report on House File 3003 to get it in front of the committee?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I will move adoption of the division report from the Preventive Health Policy Division.
All right. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. So the motion is to adopt the division report to get the bill in front of us. So this will be a voice vote. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the division report is adopted. And then Representative Freiberg, would you care to move House File 3003 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will make that motion.
All right. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. So the bill is now before the committee, and Representative Akam, welcome. Please describe your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Freiberg, for the help with that. I appreciate the time in front of the committee today, and just want to also point out there is an A1 author's amendment. It's just a very minor amendment.
Okay. So, members, there is an A1 author's amendment. I understand it's a technical amendment. It was sent to the committee, but I think that we inadvertently failed to post it within the amendment deadline. So if members are okay with it, we can adopt it now. Otherwise, the bill is being laid over, so it can always be adopted later on. Representative Freiberg would move the A1 author's amendment to get the bill in the proper shape. Representative Freiberg, if you're okay with that.
Sure, I will make that motion.
Okay. Any discussion to that, members? All right. Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A1 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Okay, go ahead as amended. Representative
Akam. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. I appreciate that. It's a very simple technical amendment, just extending the availability date of the bill. So thank you. This bill comes out of a stakeholder process from the Subcommittee on Minnesota Water Policy. A lot of you, I'm sure, are not that familiar with the subcommittee. So just give me a second and I'll tell you just briefly about the subcommittee. Because water is important, complex and controversial, as well as costly, the development of water policy needs to be undertaken thoughtfully. The subcommittee, made up of members of both parties and both bodies of our legislature, reviews water policy issues that affect Minnesota and in turn proposes legislation. During the interim, the subcommittee held hearings to explore water issues that are important to the state. The committee's recommendations have been developed based on discussions among stakeholders and state agency personnel. House File 3003 is one of those bills. As we have heard today, there's no safe level of lead, and while anyone may face health impacts when exposed to lead at elevated levels, children are the most vulnerable due to their developing brains and bodies. As Ms. Eichenauer mentioned, Minnesota requires that schools test their water every 5 years, but there is no requirement for water testing at childcare centers. As we heard, there are some grant funds that allow for testing in childcare centers, but not remediation. Since childcare facilities are usually private businesses, owners may be reluctant to test without funds to address the lead problems that they might find. Grants for remediation would help fix this issue. House File 3003 has two parts. The first is it provides funding to the Minnesota Department of Health to focus on testing for lead in private wells, daycare facilities, and rental properties, and to remediate where found. And the second part is to provide funding to improve the lead service line inventory so that information is available for people so they can make informed decisions when purchasing or renting homes. I do have one testifier that is here, and I believe Ms. Eschenauer is still here as well in case people have questions. But
yes. Thank you, Representative Akam. And I actually have Ms. Eschenauer as a testifier, and then I have Jeff Broberg, and then I also have Anna Schleep from the Department of Health. Oh, she's just here for questions. Okay. So Ms. Eschenauer, welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, but I believe I'm just available for answering questions, so I'll decline to make a statement at this time. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for being here and sticking around. All right. Mr. Broberg, good to see you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mrs. Chair. It's good to see you, and happy to be here. I'll keep it really short today. I'm Jeff Broberg. I'm one of the directors of the Minnesota Well Owners Organization, and some of you may have heard about our organization. Our focus is on healthy drinking water at the kitchen sink for private well owners. They've been an underserved class, and we've been holding free water screening clinics for nitrates and chlorides around the state, and had over 1,000 people since May of last year attend our clinics. One of the most common questions we hear is about lead. Can we test for lead? We can't in our screening clinics. It takes a certified laboratory to do the test. Cost is between $35 and $50 for that. But one of the things we see is that people that test their water are typically motivated to go farther, to figure out what's wrong and to fix it. This bill does a couple of things in those regards. The testing at childcare centers would be reported to parents, and they might think to test their own wells and their own systems for that. In schools, private wells, rental properties would all become available for grants through the health department to do the testing, and provides the means for the mitigation. And as presenters earlier have said, that can be a more complicated project because of where the sources of lead can be in private residences. Just for example, galvanized pressure tanks. Galvanized zinc has between 0.5% and 1.5% lead as a byproduct. So those things still exist in the countryside. So we have an opportunity here to do the testing, to get the awareness and motivate people to action with the help of the state for the mitigation. So I'll leave it at that and stand for any questions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Broberg. So are there any questions for members or any discussion? All right. Not seeing any hands. Representative Akam, any further comments?
No, I just thank you for the opportunity and for prioritizing this as such an important issue. I think we have a real opportunity with some of the federal infrastructure money that we can really make some progress here in our state. So thank you for the opportunity today.
All right. Well, thank you very much. So House File 3003 is laid over for possible inclusion in the health finance bill. Okay, moving on. We are now going to hear from David Kirshner with the Minnesota Office of the Legislative Auditor to talk about the recent report that he completed with his team on ambulance services. Mr. Kirshner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is David Kirshner. I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office, and I was the manager for our report on emergency ambulance services. Before I get started, I would like to note that the report was released on Friday, and we do have nice printed copies. And if any members would like to, instead of getting the virtual copy online, which of course you can all access, but if you'd like to get a printed copy, perhaps we could ask that you let the committee administrator know, and he can get me a list of any members, and we'll be sure to get printed copies to any members that want them. If I may, Madam Chair, I'd like to share my screen and make sure that everybody can see that. So
please go ahead.
There we go. Are you able to see the slide, Madam Chair?
Yes. Yes, we can.
Great. So this is a fairly detailed report, and I'm not going to have time to go through all of the pieces of it, but I want to go ahead and give you kind of the highlights of the report that we released on Friday. So our principal findings are that the process for allocating ambulance services to geographic areas within Minnesota has some problems and needs some reform. That there are no state performance standards for ambulance services. There are standards for the services capabilities, but not for performance. And we think that those should exist. We have significant concerns about ambulance services, particularly in outstate Minnesota, that are struggling with staffing and with revenue. And lastly, that the we have some real strong concerns about the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, or EMSRB, and we feel that they have not done a sufficient job in fulfilling their responsibilities. Before I get to those findings, let me give all of you some quick background on ambulance services in Minnesota. There are, or as of July 2021, there were 277 ambulance services in Minnesota. They ran over 650,000 ambulance trips in fiscal year 2021. These services are a real mixed bag of organizational structures and organizational types. Some are, you know, full-scale paid staff with paramedics and fleets of ambulances. Some are small rural services that have just volunteer staff, and there are some services that are a mix of paid and volunteer staff. And they're run by a variety of different organizations. Many ambulance services are run by local governments or by fire departments, but others are run by hospitals and healthcare systems. Some ambulance services are run by nonprofit organizations that are not connected with the hospital or healthcare system. And there are also some for-profit companies. So it's a wide mix of ambulance services within Minnesota. And there's also a mix of types of ambulance service that are available. In some communities, there is just what's called basic life support, which is basically service by an emergency medical technician. And in other areas, you do have paramedics who are able to do more sophisticated procedures and administer more medications. The Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, or EMSRB, is the agency that oversees ambulance services in Minnesota. It licenses ambulance services and it certifies individuals, that is paramedics and EMTs. It also conducts investigations, it does inspections of services, and provides grants to regional organizations. So with that basic background out of the way, I want to start off by talking about primary service areas. These are the geographic areas that are associated with each ambulance service license. So every ambulance service that has a license to provide 911 service has a primary service area in which it provides that service. Those primary service areas were first created in the 1980s, and there are some requirements for ambulance services with regard to those areas. Ambulance services must ensure coverage 24 hours a day, 7 days a week within the primary service area. And the service cannot deny care to anybody within the primary service area based upon their ability to pay. So they have to cover the entire primary service area, and they have to cover it at all times and to anybody who's in that area. In the back of our report, we present maps that show all of the primary service areas in the state. And on this slide, I'm going to show you just a small piece of one of those maps. This is in far southern Minnesota in Martin and Faribault counties. And as you can see, we have dots on the map that indicate the towns in that area. Fairmont and Blue Earth are, of course, the county seats. And as you can see, we have shaded areas, which are the primary service areas for the ambulance services in that area. And I want to point out that those primary service areas cover not just the city limits, but actually extend beyond the city limits and cover surrounding townships and other small communities. So that primary service areas typically bring together lower population areas with higher population areas. And for the ambulance service to operate, it needs to cover the entire area, both the areas that have very few people in them and the areas that are more populated. In general, we found that the primary service area system has worked kind of as intended. It has helped to ensure that all Minnesotans have access to ambulances by tying together those lower population areas, which might not have enough population to sustain an ambulance service by themselves, with higher population areas. However, there are some significant problems with the system. First of all, when the system was set up in the 1980s, it was not set up in a way that was designed to change with the times. The only way in which primary service areas can be changed is if the ambulance services themselves request changes. But there have been a lot of significant changes in Minnesota in the last 40 years, changes to population, to infrastructure, to transportation, to healthcare, to communications technology and information technology. And all of those changes may make it so that some of those primary service areas lines are perhaps not where they should still be, but there's not a good process for changing those unless it's something that the ambulance services themselves request. There are also significant disparities in terms of local control. The way in which primary service areas are allocated to ambulance services depends an awful lot on historical precedent. That is, because of whoever was providing ambulance service in the early 1980s, that was who ended up getting control of the primary service area. If it was a city that was providing the service at the time, the city ended up with control. But if it was a hospital or a nonprofit organization, that entity ended up getting control. And so we have differences between communities where, for example, St. Paul controls who provides ambulance service in St. Paul, but Minneapolis does not. International Falls has control, but Crookston does not. Red Wing has control, but Owatonna does not. So there are these really significant disparities in terms of which communities have the ability to have some say into who provides ambulance service in their area. So we have recommendations for the legislature with regard to primary service area. The legislature, we think, should keep the primary service areas because of that ability to ensure ambulance care throughout the state, both in low population and high population areas. But we think that primary service area system should be, there should be changes in how primary service areas are created, modified, and overseen. We think that the legislature should develop a process for periodically reviewing the boundaries to see if they need to be updated as we go through changes in demographics and technology and other things. And we also think that there should be a way in which local units of government have some form of input into the service that is provided in that area. I want to move on now to talk about accountability. There are standards in law for ambulance service provision, but they focus primarily on the capabilities of the ambulance service, what equipment is on the ambulance, what training ambulance crew members have. There are not standards around performance. Did you actually do what you were supposed to do? So for example, paramedics are supposed to be trained in order to be able to successfully intubate patients, that is, to put a breathing tube down a patient's trachea or windpipe. But we do not have standards that say, well, how many times did you attempt to do that and how many, what percentage of that time did you do that successfully on the first try? EMSRB has the authority in law to set standards like that, but it has not done so. There are also, however, some issues with regard to EMSRB not having
Go ahead. I'm not stopping you. Please go. Continue.
He's muted, Chair.
Testing, 1, 2, 3. Can everyone hear me? All right. I have something appearing in the middle of my screen. Are you guys seeing that?
Yes.
Let me see if I can quickly get rid of that. Hang on just 1 second. Oh, my goodness. I'm afraid it's still there. I apologize. I thought that might get rid of it. My apologies, Madam Chair. I don't know how to get rid of that very easily. I will try to soldier on, but it's going to be hard for you to see the slides. Madam Chair, what would you like me to do? I can stop showing the slides and just talk off the cuff, or I can show the slides and this thing will be in the middle of it, which would
well,
be, make the most sense.
I think we can continue. Just,
all right.
I think we can see it well enough and with your explanations, and it's kind of fading anyway, so please.
Yeah, I'm afraid it's flashing. It's coming and going. All right. Well, I will move forward keeping the slides up, but my apologies to the committee. I'm not
no
sure
problem.
Why that's
all
happening.
Right.
We do think that EMSRB does lack the authority to set some standards that it should have. So I will go to our recommendations with regard to accountability. The legislature should require EMSRB to set and enforce performance standards. We think that that would be appropriate. But we also think that it might be appropriate for EMSRB to work together with the legislature to determine whether or not it needs additional authority. Let me move on to talk about sustainability of ambulance services. As I mentioned, many ambulance services in outstate Minnesota are struggling with staffing and with revenue. We found that this is very distracting with the thing on the screen. 30% of ambulance service directors in a survey that we conducted said that they were not confident their services would be able to meet the needs of their communities in 5 years. We found that to be quite a disturbingly high number, and the number was even higher among all volunteer services, over 40% of volunteer services. Some services are unable to respond at times and must rely on their neighboring services to provide coverage because they simply do not have staff. This is a problem that is nationwide. It's not just confined to Minnesota. And there are a lot of suggestions that are out there in the policy, EMS policy community. We think most of those suggestions are untested and unproven. And so our suggestion is that the legislature should experiment with strategies to support struggling ambulance services, perhaps by putting out trial policies with sunset dates, or maybe doing some pilot policies, pilot projects that involve a few services and see how well they work. I want to talk lastly about the performance of the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, and we had some significant concerns about that board's performance. The EMSRB does not have a statewide plan or strategy for how it conducts its operations. Sustainability issues have been a major concern over the last decade or more, but the board has not taken action on those sustainability issues. There have been, the board has not updated its administrative regulations in over two decades. There is a law on the books that requires the board to collect financial data from ambulance services. Not only have they not done that, they were not aware that the law existed until we raised the question with them. And as I noted, primary service areas are a fundamental part of ambulance service licenses, but there is no publication. The board has not published primary service area maps. The maps that we show in the back of our report are the first time that those have been published statewide, even though primary service areas have been around for nearly 40 years. The Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board oversight of the agency has not been sufficient. The main way in which a board evaluates the agency it oversees is by evaluating the executive director, but the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board has not done a formal evaluation of its executive director in over 5 years. The agency was formed originally with 17 staff in 1996. They allowed that to drop to as few as 3 staff in recent years. And with that small number of staff, as you might expect, some things were not getting done. Inspections were not getting done. Investigations were not getting done. The board had moved to a fairly low level of activity. And that lack of staff was not due to lack of funds. The EMSRB, in fact, returned money to the general fund in each of the last 3 biennia, as much as $1.2 million in one of those biennia. So we have a number of recommendations with regard to the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. First, we think that the legislature should require EMSRB to create a statewide emergency medical services plan that has goals and deadlines for action, and then that the board should come back to the legislature and report on how it has met that plan and update the plan for the next several years. We think that the legislature should require EMSRB to regularly evaluate its executive director. That's not something that's ordinarily in law, but they have not been doing it, and so we think the legislature should put it into law. We have a variety of recommendations for the EMSRB. The board needs to improve its oversight of the agency. It needs to ensure the agency has sufficient staff to carry out its responsibilities. They need to begin collecting the financial data that is required by law. They need to update their administrative rules, and they should publish primary service area maps. Lastly, because we have such significant concerns about the performance of EMSRB, we do suggest that the legislature should consider whether or not broader structural changes are needed. And that could involve changing the composition of the board, for example, by increasing the percentage of public members on the board. There could be term limits for board members. The legislature might consider moving some of EMSRB's functions elsewhere, perhaps having the Department of Health oversee ambulance service organizations and leave EMSRB to regulate individual EMTs and paramedics. or the legislature could simply keep the status quo as it is. But if that is the case, we do strongly recommend that the legislature monitor the efforts that EMSRB has already begun taking to make improvements and to meet the recommendations in this report. And with that, Madam Chair, I am going to stop my screen sharing and get rid of this awful orange window that keeps popping up. And I would be happy to take questions. And my apologies to the committee for not being quick enough on how to get rid of that that window.
Well,
I'm embarrassed.
Mr. Kirshner, don't be embarrassed at all. No, this is in our virtual world here. Stuff happens, right? It just does. We don't have total control. But I do want to thank you again, you and your staff, for your great work. And I see that Representative Backer has his hand up, but I just want to acknowledge and thank him, Representative Backer, and Representative Hewitt, who have pushed this forward and really continued to work on it. And even though we're running through this rather quickly today, I think members can see that there's a lot here. And I don't have a hard copy, and I know I want one, so I think maybe the thing to do with Mr. Kirshner would be just to send all the members of this committee a hard copy, because I think every member of this committee is going to want to dig into this, because it's really front and center for us. So please do that.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll get those over to the Capitol today or tomorrow.
That would be just great. And we're not all there. But,
I'm sorry, the State Office Building. Yes.
Actually, we're not all there either, because some of us are virtual. But, you know, I think we should all have a copy. And so thank you for that. And so we do have some time for questions, which I'm glad we do. Representative Backer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And like yourself, I would definitely want a hard copy, because one of the things I've been living this type of scenario in greater Minnesota for 27 years. My first question to you, and I did not, I would like you to share with the other members here, and your report was thorough, is how are most of the members appointed to the board?
Mr. Kirshner?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative Backer. This is a typical board where the governor appoints the members of the board, and the governor appoints the chair. So that, and they are on staggered terms, so that roughly a third of the board is appointed each year, I believe.
Yeah.
Representative Backer?
Yeah, and that's something, and I appreciate that. That was not a gotcha question, but I would want to share with the members. I know a lot of boards work that way, but it doesn't matter what side of the aisle you're on. I don't believe that's the best way to support members to this board. And that's a real concern. You know, I know this report spent a lot of time on the board. And that's what this audit was. But Representative Hewitt and I have been working on bills that also address the workforce issue. The chair and I have had some personal meetings on this. Also, us three, and I appreciate that, because it is a real concern. You know, I'll use my service as an example. Right when I'm in the district, which I tried to be in as much as possible, I am only one of the three EMTs in our service. We cover a 920-mile area, and so it is not uncommon that I'm on call 400 to 440 hours, even when I'm down at the St. Paul. So when we make these looks, and I, as chair knows, I've been one of the leads with Representative Hewitt, we do need to make some significant changes with the workforce. And us too, we've got quite a few bills that we've been working forward. So I do appreciate the report. This is something that we've seen out in greater Minnesota. Right now, I hate to say it, but the board really, outside of saying, hey, you have to make sure you do your training, that's really all we have seen with the board. We have seen that some funds get passed down to the region, but we are generally not lacking equipment. What we are generally lacking in greater Minnesota is the people to serve time, and that's why we have some of those. So I do appreciate the report. I agree with a lot of it, but with it today, I will dig into it even further. And we'll we'll be continuing to work on that. Thank you, Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Backer. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Kirchner. I appreciate the work that you and your team did on this. I know that's a big task to undertake to do such a systematic review, and I'm grateful for it. I have a question about a program that you might be familiar with as it relates to ambulance services, and that's revenue recapture. And it would come up in the context of the sustainability, the financial sustainability. And for people who might not know what it is, in law, any ambulance service licensed under Chapter 144E can collect unpaid medical debt by getting funds from through the Department of Revenue. So tax returns can be garnished essentially using the state mechanism. The numbers on that range anywhere from $5,000 for a service, $50,000 in a year, all the way up to over $1 million for some of the large corporate ones. And to me, I'm troubled that ambulance services are essentially subsidizing their operational funding on the backs of people who can't afford medical debt in a really pretty messed up medical system. So I'm just curious if you did look at that at all, and just wanted to tee that up as something that I would like to see addressed as the work goes forward. Thank you.
Mr. Kirchner?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Ryer, for the question. We did not look specifically at that particular issue. We looked more broadly at the extent to which ambulance services were able to simply sustain their operations. And frankly, there are a lot of ambulance services, particularly in outstate Minnesota, that are really having difficulty with revenue. And then you compare that to ambulance services that serve very high population areas, for example, you know, in the center of the metro area or in, you know, Rochester, Duluth, St. Cloud. You're dealing with kind of two very different stories in terms of the revenue picture there. I think one of the things that is worth noting is that the services that have the most ability to work the system that you're talking about may be the ones that need the revenue. I don't want to say that they don't need the revenue, because of course they're doing a lot of work and providing an important public service, but they are not the ones that are struggling to whether or not they can actually, you know, make ends meet. The services that are really, really struggling are those where they have, you know, all volunteers and they don't necessarily have the organizational infrastructure to pursue some of those types of ways of gaining additional revenue, because that additional paperwork, you know, requires additional work in order to make it happen. So that's the observation that I will make, but we did not directly address revenue recapture in the report.
All right, thank you. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Mr. Kirchner. I appreciate that. And to me, one of the things that is really telling is that the scope of the issues related to financial sustainability go far beyond whether or not each ambulance service can use revenue recapture. It's not going to be the salvation of them. And I, like everyone, I know every person in Minnesota deserves to have an ambulance come for them when they need it, committed to making sure that happens, and looking forward to the more comprehensive solutions. Thanks so much.
All right, thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Mr. Kirchner, for this outstanding job that you just completed. I worked with these people before coming in the legislature, and I know the task you took, and I really commend you and your staff for an excellent job. You, like you said, you took a high view. There's definitely more avenues I bet could go down, but I think this gives this committee, who's going to definitely help me and hopefully support me in the task in front of us, that we all are going to benefit from this in our communities. This is not just about Metro. This reaches into the Wheaton, Minnesota, up to the Iron Range and way down to the south. And it's a task that we're going to have to take on, and not necessarily in this session alone. This is going to be something that we continue. And I'm looking forward to helping and tackling it. But I hope most of you are there with me. And again, I can't thank the auditor enough for this wonderful piece of work you guys have done. And I look forward to using it as kind of our scope of where we need to go. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. And I have a question too, Mr. Kirshner, kind of a little bit follows on Representative Ryer's question. And that is, to what degree did you look at the, you said you looked at revenue to a degree that's coming in to sustain the ambulance services, but to what degree were you able or did you look at costs for consumers? Is that part of this or really outside the scope?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We would have liked to look at costs for consumers, and there were two difficulties. One was just simply time, but another was is that there's not an easy way for us to get at that as the Legislative Auditor's Office. We can require, we could have required all of the ambulance services that were run by governments, so ambulance services run by fire departments or ambulance services that were run as a department of a city to provide us with things like billing information. But for services that are run by non-governmental entities like hospitals or nonprofit organizations, we would not have that same authority. We would only be able to require billing information with regard to individuals who are paid for by public programs. Again, that's kind of where our authority lies. And so we had difficulty getting to a kind of more complete picture in terms of billing. However, we did ask ambulance services about their kind of base rates. And we do have some information on those base rates in our report in the chapter on sustainability, but that is taken from survey data, not necessarily from actual financial data, because we did not have the authority to request that. And so it depended on what services chose to share with us. So that I think it would have been very interesting to collect more of that information. And I will point out that one of the pieces that we raised is that there is a requirement in law that the MSRB collect certain types of financial information, which could include some of those things, but it has not been collecting that information. One of the things that I think is unclear to EMSRB at this point, because we have talked with them about this recommendation, is I'm not sure they are quite clear on what the legislature wants them to collect with regard to that law, because that law was passed in 1996, and there's frankly nobody left at the agency who remembers why it was passed or what the legislature was thinking of at that time. So I do think that there may be some good conversations that could be had between legislators and EMSRB about what might be the best use of that authority that the legislature has given EMSRB to collect that kind of information.
All right, thank you for that, Mr. Kirshner. I guess I would just throw out one thought on that, and that is we have this thing called the All Payer Claims Database, and I don't know if it collects ambulance charges, probably not. I don't know if there's someone from the Department of Health here that would know that. I wouldn't expect there to be, but that's another way to possibly get at this, because then you're collecting every single bill and claim, and then you can really look at it and know that you've got all the information. But anyway, more to come on this for sure. There's a lot of rabbit holes to go down on this for sure. Representative Backer.
Yeah, one more thing, and thank you, Chair. One of the things in regards with payment, you know, we are, and I know in the district I represent, a large part is that volunteer service. So our service, just for other members, just like the auditor reported, he nailed it. Our service, we are subsidized by the taxpayers of Browns Valley. Plus, my wife and I head up a fundraiser every year so we can bring in another $25,000 to $35,000 just to keep the rake going out of the door. And that gets in a whole nother discussion of reimbursements. You know, we are paid anywhere from 60, as low as 40% on a dollar to very few private insurance that we get full payment. I was talking to our manager over the weekend, and she goes, we got payment on a motorcycle accident where the gentleman put the motorcycle, happened, he hit a deer, and it went on the side of the road. It was one of our few payments last year that we got full payment on because of private insurance. So that revenue for the service becomes very difficult, because what happens is that as a volunteer is myself and my other crew members across the state, we are subsidizing that service with our time significantly. So something to share with other members, and I do appreciate you allowing me to share that, Chair.
Yeah, thank you for that. Representative Backer, and thank you for that service that you provide. And I have been acutely aware for a long time that we have parts of our state that are indeed being kept afloat by the volunteers, which when I came to legislature and started to learn that that was how we provided a lot of our ambulance service, it just blew me away that people like you are willing to do that and put in all the time and the training and everything that you do in order to provide that service. So, I mean, that's just a tremendous thing. And we, you know, volunteers are wonderful, but boy, we got to make sure that we provide the service in a way that's equitable, and that while we want to, you know, utilize and honor our volunteers, we don't want to force them to be carrying the full load. It just doesn't seem just for us to do that. Mr. Kirshner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to comment on that. I wanted to mention one anecdote that we tell in the report of one ambulance service that we spoke with in outstate Minnesota. Their staffing challenges are such that they have come up with a somewhat novel solution. They have high school students as ambulance drivers. And so whenever a call comes in, then they let the school know, and the high school student leaves the school and goes and drives the ambulance while the EMT takes care of the patient. And they thought, you know, the students actually get, you know, credit actually as for taking a class for doing this. But that is the level of the difficulty that some ambulance services have in getting insufficient staffing in some places in outstate Minnesota.
Yeah, wow. That's just really wow. Okay, well, once again, Mr. Kirshner, I'm not seeing any other hands. I think there is a lot to talk about here, and I just want to acknowledge that Dylan Ferguson is here, who's the new executive director of the board. And what a time to be the new executive director. And we're grateful to have him here. And we are going to be talking about this more, I'm sure, and some of it this session. You know, we need to just acknowledge that we're pretty far through the session now already, and this is going to be a big lift. This is going to be complicated. There are going to be a lot of ins and outs to it, but we hope to be able to move some legislation this year and get started on some reforms, and we'll look forward to seeing some bills and discussing some bills. And we once again, really thank you, Mr. Kirshner, and your entire team, because this is a big team effort. And this is a really great service that you've done for all of us. So thank you. So members, we have a number of bills tomorrow on our agenda, and we're going to hear a number of bills around prescription drugs and cost sharing, and that will be another interesting day for us, I think. So with that, we will see you all tomorrow, and we stand adjourned.